We're interviewing Jim Mottler. Jim was the executive director, is that right, of the Montana Coal Council?
That's correct, yep.
For about 20 years, I believe. This interview is taking place on September 28th, 1975, in Jim's home. Actually, I think he was the director of the Coal Council for closer to 30 years, weren't you?
I was, 29 years. It's 2005, Bob, not 1975, but that's all right.
And you were a member of the Wyoming legislature prior to coming to Montana. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I was born and raised on a small mountain ranch in Du Bois, Wyoming, and with my brother and I wound up with that ranch and then eventually sold it and went to the Bighorn Basin in Wyoming. I stayed there for a number of years. I was in the real estate business there and wound up in the Wyoming legislature, which I thoroughly enjoyed. It was the most fascinating thing I ever did. And I managed to pretty well get bored with my real estate business after that experience, and this job opened up here, and my brother-in-law was the executive director of the Wyoming Mining Association, and he told me about it being open, and so I applied for it, and the rest is history.
And you were, make sure I mentioned your name here, Jim Mottler. Jim, you were not in Montana when the 30% coal tax was enacted in 1975, but you came here shortly afterwards.
I was. I was in Wyoming, and frankly, Bob, I thought the passage of the 30% coal tax was a wonderful thing for Montana to do. I was vice chairman and sat as chairman that year of the Wyoming Taxation Committee. We needed jobs. We, like I guess any legislature puts out, portends that they want jobs, and we did. And the coal industry was new. It was a new industry to the West, and we knew that it would develop, at least we hoped it would develop, and Wyoming wanted the jobs, and we felt at the time when Montana passed the severance tax that they just handed us the industry on a silver platter, and we thought it was wonderful. I came up here then, that was done in 1975, and I came up here and started work the August of 1976.
Jim, is there evidence that perhaps you were right, or is there inconclusive evidence? What evidence would there be about the 30% coal tax?
Oh, I think that the evidence is clear. The projections were by both the industry and the EISs and all that were done at the time that the industry would develop roughly equal in the two states. Perhaps Wyoming would be a little ahead of Montana because it was closer to some of the states of the markets. But we would have been given the entire Midwest, upper Midwest especially. The central Midwest would be split between the two states, and in the areas of the south would tend to be more toward Wyoming. Those were pretty much the general and logical ways for the industry to develop. Well, what happened when they passed the tax is that the industry not only went to Wyoming, but everything that went with it went to Wyoming. And the railroads went to Wyoming, and they got Union Pacific was able to pick up another small railroad, which eludes my name right now, into the Powder River Basin. So they had two railroads. And those two railroads were built double track. So into that area. So they built the infrastructure. That was the key then to the future development, was the building of that infrastructure into the Wyoming coal fields.
And you feel that infrastructure was built into the Wyoming coal fields because the Montana tax was so high?
Yes, I do. I think it made it easy then for the railroads to do, because they in turn felt we can put a huge investment in here. We don't have to invest in both states. We can put this very large investment in Burlington Northern would have been our only railroad anyway. But they didn't have to build in Montana then. They could go ahead and put their investments into Wyoming and haul the coal from Wyoming. And
Wyoming,
that's what they did.
Wyoming had a tax too.
Wyoming had a tax too. It was a little less than half of Montana's.
I see.
And they, yeah, their taxes still weren't cheap down there, but they were. I think it, to be honest with you, Bob, I think it was the connotation of the tax, perhaps as much as the tax itself. That really hurt.
The message the tax sent.
It was a message the tax sent, and of course it was the tax itself at the time. But the utilities who were buying the coal said, "Hell, why would we want to deal with those people?"
Yeah.
And in those days, they sold coal on long term contracts. They'd sell it for 20-year contracts and some longer. And the utilities just said, "Why would we want to deal with those people?" And so the message that Wyoming portrayed was the one that we wanted to portray. We wanted the industry. We wanted their business. And I think that paid off and really hurt Montana.
When we talk about a 30% tax, which was where it was in 1975, I think, when the legislature first initiated it, can you explain how that works? I mean, it's 30% of what?
Well, it was a 30% of the gross tax paid on the coal. In other words, the FOB mine price of the coal loaded on the car less the taxes it paid on production. So at least you didn't have to compound it by paying on the taxes themselves, or the so-called gross proceeds tax, which at that time was based on the mill levies on the coal.
Could we understand?
About 5%.
It's like it would have amounted to 30% of the gross value of the coal at the mouth of the strip mine. Is that?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Gross value of the coal as you didn't get any net. In other words, there was no production cost deducted. It was the gross value of the coal, with the exception of the taxes and at that time royalties paid on production.
Was the Wyoming tax? Do you remember how was that implemented in the same way, or was that?
No, the Wyoming tax is a little different, and that always leads to great grand arguments on taxes. The Wyoming tax, you get to was based on the value of the coal at the face of the mine. In other words, they got to deduct all their costs for hauling the coal to the crushers, the crushing, the loading. They got to deduct those costs. I think since then they've changed it, but at that time that was what it was based on.
And the net effect was that Montana's tax was a little more than double Wyoming's tax at the
yes.
bottom line.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
And but Wyoming has made a fair amount of money, I think, from
Well, the Wyoming now produces, we're still in the 35 million ton production range, which fortunately we got to after they lowered the tax.
We're talking Montana.
Montana, and Wyoming's in 350 million ton.
So Montana.
So we really should be about, Montana should probably be about 150 and Wyoming 200 million or two, you know.
But
that's about where we should
350
be.
And we're 35.
Right.
So 10 times
right.
what we are.
So they have all the jobs, and half the tax of 350 million tons is a hell of a lot more than all of the tax on 35. And really the net effect then, when those contracts started coming up for renewal, I think was dramatic, because had they not lowered the tax, we would not have a coal industry other than at Colstrip for the power plants. That probably would still be there just because of the economics of shipping it in, and that isn't even for certain.
Do you remember, or maybe the best way to ask the question is, were there significant differences between Wyoming law and Montana law in terms of, land rehabilitation, environmental protection, that type of thing?
No, there was very little difference. The federal act was imminent at that time that it would be passed. But even before that, there was very little difference. We had Wyoming had a good workable reclamation law that required reclamation. The paperwork changed a lot over the years, but I don't think the bottom line did, and that was that they would reclaim the land.
So you arrived in Montana in 1976, and you've got a big job ahead of you representing the coal industry in light of this big tax difference. And obviously, there's an interest on the part of people in the coal business to develop the coal in Montana. And there was some development, apparently, in the face of this tax. But what did you do? You must have been interested in somehow or other trying to reduce that tax.
I was. And I actually thought, Bob, that I could get that job done in a very short time. That wouldn't take much to explain to the people what was happening. And and to show them what was happening, because Wyoming at then was starting to progress. Both their production in both states was around 25 million. Wyoming was actually a little less. So it was all in the development stage, but Wyoming was obviously being developed, and Montana wasn't. And I thought it'd be a pretty simple thing to show the people of Montana that was happening, and that they should correct their mistake.
Do you think, why do you think the tax was established at 30% in Montana?
I frankly think they just pulled it out of the hat. It was something that was very high. I think the mood of the legislature at that time was a very, I call them liberal, populist, whatever you wish to call them, controlled. They had solid control. In other words, the people, Tom Tow, was the sponsor of the bill, but there's no evidence that there was anything scientific. They had interim studies done, suggested that the tax perhaps should be as high as 15%. There was nothing there that is perceptive to me to come in and look at the history.
But you mentioned that Wyoming was, there was a consensus, it sounds like, in Wyoming to develop the coal. There was a feeling that the coal should be developed. And that had probably something to do with the level at which the tax was set in Wyoming. In other words, you didn't want to kill the goose that you thought might lay the golden egg. Is that
well, correct? I'm sure that that's true. In Wyoming, albeit a different state, but Wyoming lived and died on with the oil industry.
Yeah.
And agriculture, of course, just like Montana did with the copper. Except that Wyoming never did resent the oil industry like Montana came to resent the copper industry. And I guess when we saw the opportunity for another mineral development and jobs, we could see the long term. We could see the good side. We could see the bad side. We knew that little communities like Gillette, Wyoming, would be completely overrun. But I guess that was an option that we decided to take at the time and pursued it aggressively.
Well, I can remember, I was in the legislature at that time, and I can remember this feeling of resentment toward the old Anaconda Company over the copper development in Butte, and that there was a big open pit mine in Butte that was, some people were shocked to see, and that probably could never really be restored to the way it had been. And there was the feeling that the state of Montana hadn't received very much for all the coal or all the copper that had been developed out of Butte. Whether that's accurate or not, that was repeated a lot. And so the idea was, now we've got this new big, what amounts to a strip mine or an open pit mining operation, and we got burned by the last one, so we're going to set the tax high enough on this that if the energy crisis is severe enough, they'll mine the coal and pay through the nose to Montana, and if it's not high enough, they'll never do any mining at all, and frankly, we don't care which way it turns out. I think there was some of that, at least in the Montana legislature. Does that sound familiar?
Well, Bob, you were there, and I wasn't, but I think, yes, I think that's definitely true, and I think the level was probably decided in large part to stem the industry. In fact, the conference committee report directly says, we realize that this level of taxation will shift the business to Wyoming, and so be it. And so they obviously recognized that's what it was doing, and that was their purpose. They were using taxation to stem the industry, and as I said at the outset, the people all involved. I mean, it takes a lot of people to develop an industry, and decided, well, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. We'll put our investments in Wyoming.
So you came to Montana.
But now, after some 30 years later, we never dreamed that the industry would get to the point in Wyoming that it has today. We never dreamed it'd be that large. We thought it would be a big industry. We were talking in the perhaps as big as 150 million ton, not 350.
Yeah. And so you got to Montana, 1976. You can point to a perfect example of how Wyoming has a tax less than half as high as Montana's, and that the coal industry is booming in Wyoming. It's not in Montana, and the major difference between Montana and Wyoming is the tax. And so if Montana wants to develop its coal, all it's got to do is raise it or lower the tax. That would be you mentioned earlier in our conversation, a pretty easy case to make. But then I think you were starting to say that it wasn't. What did you run into? What happened?
Well, I guess it just, I don't know, was my inability to get that expression apart to the public or what it was. But I guess I never convinced the public or the legislature anyway. I was close.
But
it took a long time.
This past history thing, I think, though, may have had something to do with it.
I think it did. I think the past history had a lot to do with it. It became a flag for the Democrat Party, for one thing. They held it up as a flag. It was their right. Was neither whether it was right or wrong. It was their right to have that, and it was their poster child. And I am not sure where that came from. The environmental community, I mean, they were very successful in promoting that. I used to say, well, you know, if the environmental community is right, why is this the only type of taxation that they're involved in if they're not interested in stopping the industry? I mean, you know, I never hear them out on income taxes. But as my friend Ted Swindon, Governor Swindon, told me one time, and I got in a big argument with him, I said, logic and common sense will say, tell you I'm right. And he never batted an eye. He said, logic, common sense doesn't have a damn thing to do with it. We're talking politics. And obviously, he was right. He was at that time lands commissioner, and I was executive director of the Coal Council. He went on to be governor for 8 years, and I stayed as executive director of the Coal Council. So obviously, that was a huge part of it. It was when you talk politics, as you know, as long as you've been involved in them, sometimes logic, common sense, doesn't have a damn thing to do with it.
Well, Jim, you, I think, eventually persuaded Governor Swindon, didn't you?
I did.
Explain how that happened.
Well, over time.
Swindon didn't become governor until the election of 1980.
Right, and our the industry had not grown, and it took some persuasion for Governor Swindon, and it wasn't until toward the end of his term, well, 1987, that Governor Swindon had agreed then. He had tried to an experiment to see if he could increase the coal production by giving new production a tax break. That seemed to work some, but it wasn't long term, and it was pretty iffy whether it would be constitutional if it was challenged. And
was that the so-called window of opportunity?
Window of opportunity. And
it was the idea was that we reduced the coal tax from 30% to 15%.
It was 30 to 20, actually.
30 to 20?
Right.
And how did it work?
Well, if they increased the tonnage, then they would get this, you know, in other words, if they bought new coal, they would get this break.
If there was more coal mined,
right,
then they'd get the tax on the new coal that was mined, the tax break on the new coal that was mined?
Right.
I see. They continue to pay the tax on the old
coal. On the old coal.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of question in my mind when he passed it whether it was constitutional, and I think a recent court case it showed that it wasn't. But it was never challenged, and as the governor told me, when I suggested it might not be constitutional, he says, "So you're going to sue me?" And I loud as hell, I probably wouldn't do that. But you know, that was one time when environmentalists were right. They said that if you pass this bill, you'll open the window, and the industry will drive through it. And I thoroughly intend to use that, and I did, and the public by then, I think, were convinced, and it passed with a bipartisan vote. And the governor one time had in December of 86, before the 87 session, he had a group of us over at the mansion and talking about his programs and what he would like to do, and I said talked about lowering the coal tax, and I said he said he'd support lowering it to 20%. I said, how about 15? And he replied, well, Mockler, if you can get that legislature to lower it to 15%, by God, I'll sign it. And he came to rue that day, but he lived up to his word. I give the governor credit. He lived up to his word. He was extremely angry when the bill wound up on his desk at 15%.
But now the window of opportunity lowered it from 30% to 20%, and that was a temporary thing.
Right.
And then after that happened,
after that happened.
Then you persuaded the governor that we'd be better off in terms of the development of coal in Montana in the long term if the companies could count on a firm tax at 15%.
Lowered a little bit
from 20 down to 15.
What was happening was our contracts were coming up for renewal.
I see.
The big contracts with Detroit Edison and some of those companies were coming up for Minnesota Power, and some of those companies that they'd had out there for those 20 years were now starting to come up for renewal. And they had already shown that they could go to Wyoming and get their coal, and because they were doing it. They were buying coal there too. So it was just a matter of survival then at that point. And I think Governor Schwinden recognized that.
That some of the contracts wouldn't be renewed?
They would not be renewed.
Yeah.
In other words, it wasn't a matter of new coal now. It was a matter of just protecting the industry, or the industry would ultimately fail.
And do you remember about when that was?
It was 1987.
And so when was the window of opportunity?
I believe that would have been 1985, yes.
Okay. And so you got that through the legislature in 87, got it down to 15%.
Yes.
Why was Governor Schwinden upset when it got on his desk, when he told you he'd sign it?
Because it was still, for a lot of the Democrat Party, those who controlled it, even though there was a good bipartisan vote for the bill, it was still primarily a poster child for the party. The party itself felt that he had been abandoned, that Governor Schwinden had abandoned him, and I think that's why, you know, I don't know if he ever rued the day. He never did tell me that. But
there wasn't a signing ceremony. You don't have a picture?
I think I do. I think I do have a picture, but it was contentious. It was contentious. But it was fun. I lost 20 pounds, 20-some pounds that session.
But was the result that the contracts were renewed?
The contracts were pretty much renewed, yes. And they were. They were not only renewed, but they were expanded. At that time, we were on 27 million tons, slated to go to 22. And since then, we've been pretty much stagnant around 35.
And so, I guess 15% is what it would be. If we went from 30 to 15%, that would be comparable to the tax in Wyoming?
Probably would, but go back to some of my earlier statements, and that is they built the infrastructure in Wyoming, and that's probably now more important than the tax.
Sure, yeah. They got started early, and once they...
Right,
yeah.
Right. You know, Wyoming could probably put a 20 or 30% tax on their coal, and it'd still produce a hell of a lot of it because they have the infrastructure. It isn't something that you can just change overnight. And I don't think Wyoming intend to do that because they have $1 billion in excess budget. I mean, money laying in a bank now they don't know what to do with.
Assume there's a great demand for more coal development. Let's say that the current energy crisis that we're experiencing now with gasoline, you know, the price of gas skyrocketing here in year 2005, the volatility in the Middle East, concern about being as dependent as we are in that part of the world for our energy, South America, not the stablest place in the world, the area down in the Gulf of Mexico threatened by hurricanes, and just recently the refineries and so on clobbered by Hurricane Katrina, and it makes us wonder, I think, whether it might make more sense for our country to become more energy independent. And perhaps if we developed coal, which is in the interior of the country, safer from hurricanes, we might be able to use that kind of energy either as a part of modern coal technology or maybe somehow or other help us get started in the direction of hydrogen development or something like that that could be better for the country. Do you see a future for coal? And I guess my question is, that's number one. And then number two, you talked about the infrastructure. And as I understood, the Union Pacific Railroad had built those double-strength lines into the coal country so that there could be a lot of coal transported out of Wyoming. But if there was a new huge demand for coal, period, probably some of that development would be in Montana. Is there the infrastructure there to take advantage of it?
Well, you're dealing with a different infrastructure if you go to a process to make fuels. you're dealing with different infrastructure. The answer is probably no, not all of it, but a lot of it is.
Burlington
Northern still has, your coal wouldn't be hauled. They'd build it mine mouth.
The facility.
They built a facility mine mouth like they did in North Dakota with a gasification plant. Problem you have, again, is one of trust. And that is a huge problem right now with the fuels development in the United States. Back in the early 70s, in the Jimmy Carter years, they came out with programs to build gasification plants for coal, to develop oil shale, to do various programs that were designed to compete with gas at $5 a MCF and oil at $30 a barrel. And there was a number of companies that put a lot of money into it. I know Tenneco put $1 billion into North Dakota. I'm not sure who their partner was. I don't remember. Mobil put $1 billion into oil shale in Colorado, and various projects like that. And Tenneco walked away from that for a dollar. Because the government, and after all, then took the price supports away from them, jerked the rug out from under them. So there's a barrier of distrust there. Then that's compounded now with our refineries. Our refineries aren't, it isn't that people don't want to build refineries or they can't find a place necessarily to build a refinery. The problem is they don't have a clue as to what the U.S. government will do environmentally with that refinery if they try to build it. And they're at a moving target with the government now, and so people aren't willing to invest in it. They'll go to another country and invest their money there. If you're president of a company and you invest your stockholders $1 billion and you walk away from it, you're not a very popular or long-lived president. So I guess that there's a whole lot of factors there that are there, and it takes a lot of time to overcome those. The answer is yes, they could build a conversion plant somewhere, but it takes a lot of money and a lot of time to put that money together, and a lot of trust has to be gained in here in this process.
As you look in the future, what do you see in terms of energy? Do you think that something like what we're discussing now might actually happen?
I think it has to happen. Sure, I think ultimately it has to happen, and with that, either that has to happen or you have to have dramatic changes in our lifestyle. Now, you know, that's one thing that I guess is hard to understand, because people like you and I tend to read to look for the bottom line of why things happen some way. But you take the average person out there, and he says he doesn't want anything to affect the environment. I mean, and somebody comes out and says, no, you know, you're going to put tons of this stuff out of the stacks. Well, will that hurt anything? Should be the bottom line question, is will that cause physical harm? But it isn't. It's just, we like it the way it is. Well, they need to ask the next question, then what are my alternatives? And of course the alternatives are you change your diet, lifestyle dramatically. And I have got to think that push comes to shove, that the lifestyle probably will not change dramatically, that they will develop the other processes. And there's, you know, they'll develop more nuclear. There's wonderful history of safety. But people don't want to burn coal. Every time you talk about coal, you talk about global warming. Well, coal is a very small part of it. Now the big thing is mercury. You have your wonderful EPA out, going to cost the general public billions and billions of dollars to control something that they cannot identify as harmful. Crazy.
Is the mercury connected with the coal?
It is connected with coal, yeah. Yeah, they want mercury controls on coal-fired plants. I'm not sure where it'll go. Right now, of course, the governor is saying that that the technology's out there to produce
the current governor.
The current governor. Governor Schweitzer to produce diesel fuel for $1 a gallon from coal. I don't know where he got that. I've researched it quite a bit, and it's probably competitive to the at this price. It's probably competitive to conventional oil refined fuels, but that's at this price. And I go back to the, you know, we could produce a lot of oil shale at this price. We can produce it out of tar sands.
But with oil at $65 right. a gallon.
We can produce it out of tar sands for that. The technology is there to do that, but the industry is not willing to put their total neck out
on the assumption that the price of oil is going to stay there.
Right.
Will stay there, yeah.
In fact, I think most of the industry analysts at today will tell you that they're basing their investments and their projections at $35. I don't know of any that are basing it any higher than that.
Jim, going back, because I think this is important, we need to have a somewhat of a conversation about, you're a former legislator, young lobbyist in Montana. You've come up here in the late 1970s. You're a little discouraged by the fact that what seems like a strong, compelling debater's case you could make and something that would probably easily sell in Wyoming is kind of stuck in the mud in Montana. Perhaps an important part of the explanation is that there's a mistrust of mining corporations, the Anaconda Company experience, and that sort of thing. But you managed to eventually in the 1980s make some important inroads, including with the governor. And finally, you're given credit, I think, by most political observers here in Helena as being the key guy that got that coal tax reduced from 30% down to 15%. And I'm just curious to know what you remember about the strategy you used, what you remember about who the key legislators were that helped you, the ones that maybe came on board at a critical time or the ones that were the most difficult to persuade. Just maybe tell us a little bit about that story, what you remember about it.
Well, I think the key legislators in my mind that helped me the most were without a doubt, they were Stan Stevens, who was a senator at that time from Havre and of course became governor. Jack Galt, who was a senator from Martinsdale, and Alan Kahlstedt, senator from Chester. And for whatever reason, they took me under their wing. They gave me credibility that I know people that had worked for 20 and 30 years didn't have. They transferred that credibility to me, which was a tremendous asset. They opened those doors of whereas when I went to the legislature early on, they opened the door that I could be trusted. Something that I'm not sure that I earned, but I got, and that was wonderful. And then I had some people like Carol Graham from an old Democrat from down Hardin and some of those people that became good friends, and I don't know, I worked damned hard at it, but I don't know beyond that. It was work I enjoyed.
The people you mentioned have all been senators, and three of them
right.
Republican senators. Any key people you can remember in the House of Representatives?
Well, Tom Conroy was a Democrat at that time from Hardin. He was one that was helpful to me. The Republicans were all very kind to me, quite frankly, Bob. You being one of them, although you never would support lowering the coal tax, that was one of your many errors that you now admitted was wrong. But the Republicans as a whole, you know, Bob Marks, I'd have to just look through, you know, but yes, there was a lot of them, that helped me. And helped me a lot, and that was true through the years. But it, I don't know why, you know, that was one thing that always distressed me, although I was a Republican, and pretty hard to hide that since I was in the legislature and had to lay, you know. And I didn't try to necessarily, but I never felt that industry was political. And that was one thing that always distressed me. The other thing that distressed me is I saw a lot more here than I did in Wyoming, and I think that's because of the press that you have here, and which I think is horrible, always have. But anyway, they fostered a distrust for politicians, And you talk about industry not being liked. Well, they foster a distrust for politicians. When someone reads a paper every day and they have this slant that the politicians did this stuff for their own good, and it's a connotation of mistrust that is really embedded up here. And I think that is unfortunate, because I have been, my father was in politics, Wyoming legislature, as I was growing up, different area than I was, but nonetheless, I was raised with politics, I've been in politics all my life. I have never seen anyone that I thought was dishonest, that did things in politics for his own personal gain. Sure, there's people who would represent industries that would go, obviously vote to benefit that industry, but I never saw anyone who really just went out and openly, did something for their own to gain from the politics. And I've always resented that. I'd resent the lobby disclosure, because all that is a witch hunt to see. And it doesn't work evenly or open-handedly to see who supposedly is buying off the legislature. Well, that's not true. It's unfortunate. And I think that's part of the, we're up there right up with Minnesota. And if you can figure out Minnesota politics, you're really a genius. But I think that has a lot to do with it.
Now, you've mentioned some of the important people that helped to reduce the coal tax. Who were the key players? What was their strategy on the other side?
Well, of course, you had your usual environmental groups. You had the Democrat Party itself. They were openly critical to Governor Swindon, albeit he being a Democrat. They were probably the most vocal, but there was the same old argument. It doesn't make any difference. Which the proof was there by then that it did, but a number of Democrats, for example, the guys from Butte, the working guys, could see that by then that it was helping, and some of the unions, albeit the AFL-CIO, didn't, but a number of the unions came and helped. The working guys from Colstrip came up.
I remember that.
There
were a couple of busloads.
They chartered buses and came up because they could see that it was their livelihood, and they were the highest paid industry in Montana, and they wanted to keep those jobs.
And that was the 15% bill that they came over to lobby for?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And actually, it was even before that they came to lobby for that, and I had no control over that. I admit I encouraged it and encouraged them to do it. And was certainly pleased that they did, but those guys didn't do like the timber industry. They didn't just die piecemeal. They at least were going to go with a fight, because they wanted their jobs, and they could see the threat, and they understood it.
As you look back over that period of your life, the period when you represented the Montana Coal Council in the Montana State Legislature for nearly 30 years, or I think approximately 30 years, any important lessons that you feel you've learned, or any important observations you'd like to make just about your experience as a lobbyist for the mining industry?
Well, it was a good ride. I enjoyed it, Bob. I enjoyed the challenge. Actually, the shift... Since they lowered the coal tax, it was just like they slammed the door. The interest in the coal industry isn't there. I had some pretty good fights after that, but I didn't have near the public interest. And I guess the press dropped it. The coal industry is not a big deal in the press anymore. It used to be, I used to drive as many days as I could stand to sit in a car to go to talk to Rotary clubs and all across the state. And in my later years, I didn't get that, the interest just wasn't there.
There's not a lot of controversy.
The controversy isn't there, but on the other hand, sadly enough, I see them doing the same thing with coal bed methane. that they were doing with coal. It's the same families, it's the same groups, it's the same, I mean, it's just like nothing happened in 30 years. And I have to wonder whether people really did learn anything.
There's opposition to coal bed methane.
Opposition's there. They've closed it down. Wyoming is developing theirs, albeit, you know, they have a billion dollar budget surplus because of their taxes, which are their oil and gas taxes are less than ours too. But they have the industry and they're developing the industry. And sure, there's some trade-offs. There's no doubt about it. But the question is I guess Wyoming feels they're worth it. They'll go back in and reclaim the land when it's gone. They don't see the water as that big of a problem, and it isn't. It's interesting down there. They have a sodic soil to start with.
What kind of soil to start with?
Sodic. It's got a lot of sodium in it, a lot of salt. You could put distilled water on it, and because of the nature of the soils, alkali will form on top of it, because that's the way alkali is. The soils don't have good drainage, and so the alkali essentially melts in the water, and when the water dries up, well, it leaves the salt on top. So that's, you know, it has nothing to do with the water. And as you say, you could put pure water on it, and that would happen, and the water that they're using in their own wells is the same water as they wanted to use down there. It is exactly the same water. It is the water. So, I guess is all I'm saying is it's an industry that they could have had developed now, could develop, but I see the same thing happening, and I have to wonder in my mind, did we learn anything? And I guess the answer is no. We really didn't.
Anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, I appreciate it. I've enjoyed Montana. I intend to stay here. I've got a wonderful home now out on the lake and in town. It's been a good ride. It's been fun. I love the people. I've met people like yourself and others that I've mentioned, and a lot that I haven't, that have made it a good life.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Bob.